You're listening to DTFHN for February 12th, 2026. I'm your mass-produced yet artisanal host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where mass extinction events get fewer comments than text editors. Today's got that rare energy where everything old feels new and everything new feels ancient. Let's get into it. Here's what I'd wonder if I were building a spacecraft. Do you ever actually see the thing that makes your engine go? There's something almost philosophical about that. You work with xenon every day. This heavy, noble, stubbornly inert element that's perfect for ion propulsion precisely because it refuses to react with anything. You pump it through tubes, you measure its pressure, you calculate its thrust, but it's always hidden behind metal cylinders and vacuum chambers and electromagnetic fields that would ruin your day if you touched them, the fuel that moves satellites across the solar system, and you've never really met it face to face. So naturally you build a desk display, and this is where the project gets genuinely delightful, the author. Who designs ion thrusters for a living, by the way? Ordered a 5-pack of noble gas tubes off Amazon, all 5 noble gases, helium, neon, argon, krypton, and the star of the show, xenon. Each one glows a different color when you ionize it. The engineering challenge was building a stand that could actually light them up, which meant finding a high voltage RF power source, coupling it to the tubes, and not electrocuting yourself in the process. The solution, Goot, a plasma ball toy. 5 watts, somewhere around 1.5 kilovolts peak to peak at roughly 25 kilohertz. That puts the current at about 2.5 milliamps. Well within the safe zone for human exposure to AC, though still enough to make you pucker when you touch the bare wire for the first time. The author actually bought a high voltage oscilloscope probe to verify the numbers before putting fingers anywhere near it, which... And I want to emphasize this. Is exactly the right instinct. Now, here's the devil's advocate moment. You might think this is just a pretty desk toy, a conversation starter for aerospace engineers. But play it forward. This person took industrial spacecraft technology and made it tangible, touchable. You can watch xenon ionize 3 inches from your face. That kind of direct physical interaction with the phenomena you're engineering around. It changes how you think about problems. There's a reason physicists build cloud chambers and chemists keep element collections. Abstract knowledge becomes intuition when you can see it glow. The comments pick up on this too. Someone dives into the space charge limited thrust physics of why xenon specifically works so well in ion engines. Another points out that radon tubes would technically be possible. Just, you know, radioactive. The conversation naturally bridges from desk art to orbital mechanics, which is exactly the kind of rabbit hole that makes this stuff magnetic, and the crown itself. 5 tubes arranged in an arc, each gas glowing its signature color, powered by the guts of a $15 plasma ball. Sometimes the best engineering is the kind you build because you just wanted to finally see the thing you've been working with all along. We talked about building things you can finally see pause. Now imagine seeing 15 LLMs get better at coding, all in one afternoon. Line 63 of the blog post is easy to miss. It's a number 50.7%. That's Grok 4's patch failure rate when asked to use OpenAI's apply patch format, not because Grok 4 is a bad model, but because nobody told it the rules of a game it was never trained to play. Run this forward. Right now, the entire industry conversation is about which model is smarter, Opus or GPT-5.3 Gemini versus whatever shipped Tuesday. But Kenduruk did something yesterday that should reframe that debate entirely. He changed one variable in his coding agent. The edit tool, and improved the benchmark performance of 15 models simultaneously, not by making the models better, by making the interface between the model and your code less hostile. The state of the art is genuinely messy. Claude Code uses string replacement, which means the model has to reproduce every character of the target text perfectly, white space included, or the edit fails. The string to replace not found error is so common it has its own mega thread on GitHub. OpenAI's Codex uses a custom diff format that works beautifully if you're a model that's been specifically biased to produce it, and catastrophically if you're not. Cursor's solution was to train an entirely separate 70 billion parameter model just to merge edits correctly. Think about that engineering choice. The problem of how do you change a file is so unsolved that one of the best funded AI companies decided the answer was another neural network. What Duruk built instead is a line addressed edit tool using stable hash identifiers. The model doesn't have to reproduce code verbatim. It points to exactly which lines it means, verifiably, without the token waste of reproducing context. One afternoon of work, 15 models improved. This is an open source project, by the way, a fork of Pi, another open source coding agent with 1300 commits of incremental improvement. The harness code is right there. Anybody can read it, fork it, adapt the idea. And that matters because the insight here isn't just technical. It's structural. The bottleneck between a capable model and a useful tool is not intelligence, it's plumbing. And plumbing is exactly the kind of problem that gets solved faster when more people can see the pipes. The JetBrains research confirms that systematically no single edit format dominates across models. The format matters as much as the model, which means every percentage point we've been attributing to model quality might actually belong to the harness that's quietly botching the handoff. Now for something completely different. Story 3, Warcraft 3, peon voice notifications for Claude Code. One commenter put it perfectly. Finally, someone doing actual good work with LLMs instead of Claude, ship me out another useless SARS. And that line landed because it captures something the Hacker News thread kept circling back to. The gap between what people build with AI tools and what actually makes those tools better to use. The project is called Peon Ping. It's a shell hook for Claude Code that plays Warcraft 3 peon voice lines when your coding agent finishes a task or needs permission. Work, work, something need doing. Me busy, leave me alone, that last one fires, when you submit three or more prompts in 10 seconds. A direct callback to the Warcraft click spam Easter eggs from 2002, which themselves descended from the original Warcraft in 1994. One commenter traced the lineage all the way back, remembering how Blizzard's units would get progressively more annoyed the more you clicked them. The human soldiers' escalating irritation became a genre convention that persisted across RTS games for a decade. The technical substance here is surprisingly clean. One shell script registered as a Claude Code hook across four events. Session starts, prompt submit, stop a notification. It uses AFPlay on macOS, PowerShell, Media Player on WSL2. Configuration is a JSON file. Install is a single curl pipe to bash. The architecture is exactly as simple as it should be. What makes this worth discussing is the problem it solves. Claude Code has no native notification system. You fire off a task, tab away, and 15 minutes later you remember you were waiting for something. That's a workflow gap in a tool millions of developers use daily, and it got solved by one person with a shell script and some WAV files ripped from a 23-year-old game, 10 seconds to install. The whole thing is open source on GitHub, MIT licensed, with a contributing guide for adding new sound packs. Community already shipped French and Polish peon voices, a red alert to Soviet engineer StarCraft's Kerrigan and Battlecruiser. Now, one commenter raised the copyright question. Warcraft 3 audio assets redistributed without a license from Blizzard? That's a real issue, and it's worth naming. But the broader pattern here is instructive. The gap between a powerful tool and a usable tool is often something this small, a sound, a notification, a moment of feedback that keeps you in flow, and that gap gets closed fastest when the tool is hookable, the solution is forkable, and anybody can hear the peon say okie dokie when their agent finishes refactoring. Four stories in and we're already mass mixing Warcraft sound effects with GPU drivers. Pause, this is exactly the kind of day I love. In 1995, the Linux FreiBuffer subsystem was brand new, and nobody was sure whether the kernel should manage graphics hardware at all. The argument was simple. GPUs are complex, drivers are fragile, and maybe user space should handle everything. Three decades later, the DRM subsystem is the backbone of every Linux display stack on the planet, and Dave Ehrle just announced at the Maintainers Summit that within a year, new drivers written in C won't even be accepted, only Rust. That's the context for Tyr. And the question nobody seems to be asking directly is this: can a Rust GPU driver actually ship on a phone that a billion people use? Because Mali isn't some niche embedded chip arm, Mali is the GPU in the majority of Android phones worldwide. When you talk about upstreaming a Rust driver for Mali, you're talking about the path toward Rust graphics code running in the pockets of a significant fraction of humanity. The scale is staggering, and the engineering team knows that Arm, Collabora, and Google built a prototype that plays Super Tux Card at Linux Plumbers. That's fun, that's a demo. But between a demo and a deployable driver, there's a canyon, and the team is refreshingly honest about what's in it. No power management, no frequency scaling, no GPU recovery. Three words that sound minor until you imagine your phone burning through 40% battery in an hour, and then hard locking when a shader goes sideways. The Rust abstractions to even support these features don't exist yet in the kernel. They have to be designed, reviewed, upstreamed, and stabilized before Tire can use them. That's not a Tire problem. That's an ecosystem problem, and solving it benefits every future Rust driver, not just this one. The craft here deserves real admiration. The team merged a skeleton into the 6.18 kernel, kept a downstream branch for the working prototype, and drew a clear line between what proves the concept and what ships to users. That discipline, prototype to learn, upstream to last, is how you build infrastructure that survives contact with reality, and the upstream part matters enormously. Tier is evolving alongside Nova, the Rust GPU driver for NVIDIA hardware. Every abstraction they design, every safe interface they negotiate with the DRM maintainers becomes shared scaffolding. The work compounds a power management abstraction built for Mali becomes available to every Rust driver that follows. Let's pull this thread all the way forward. If the DRM subsystem locks out new C drivers next year, and Tier and Nova have built the foundational Rust abstractions, then every new GPU that wants Linux support has a head start instead of a blank page. That's how open source wins. Not by decree, but by making the right path the easiest path. We talked about building trust into systems earlier. Pause Story 5 asks, what happens when that trust gets tested by teenagers? The fundamental problem with age verification on the internet is that it's a classification task performed on an adversarial channel. You're asking a remote client, a device you don't control, to prove something about the human sitting in front of it. And the moment you decide, for privacy reasons, that you won't transmit the raw biometric data to your server, you've made an architectural choice with consequences. KID, the provider Discord uses, made exactly this choice. Instead of sending your actual face to a server, they send metadata. Processed outputs, prediction arrays, device information, timing data, and from a privacy standpoint, that's genuinely better than the providers shipping full video of your face to some third-party cloud. But here's the unintended consequence. If the server never sees the real biometric input, it can only validate the statistical shape of the output, and statistical shapes can be manufactured. That's precisely what two researchers did. They reverse engineered the payload format, replicated the AES GCM encryption using the derivable key material, and then figured out how the prediction arrays, the raw numbers, the Z-score outlier removal, the mapping to age outputs, all fit together. The metadata had to look right. Camera names matching real device lists, state completion times matching the timeline, specific shift values instead of random ones. But once you understand the structure, you can generate a payload that's statistically indistinguishable from a legitimate adult verification. The server literally cannot tell the difference because it threw away the information that would let it tell the difference. Now, one commenter raised a point worth sitting with. Discord's October 2025 breach leaked 70,000 government IDs from their support vendor, which is part of what pushed them toward this on-device approach. They traded one vulnerability for another. The old way leaked your identity documents, the new way is trivially bypassable. Both architectures fail, just in different directions. And this is where the comedy of unintended consequences lands. Age verification on the open internet is fundamentally a policy fiction implemented as an engineering problem. You can make it privacy preserving or you can make it robust, but you probably can't do both when the client is adversarial. The researchers published everything open source on GitHub. The bypass is currently broken while KID patches, and the cycle will continue. Each fix makes the metadata more complex. Each complexity creates new surface area to reverse engineer. The real question isn't whether this particular bypass gets fixed, it's whether anyone involved has noticed they're playing whack-a-mole on a game board. They're designed to be unwinnable. From unwinnable games in DRM to unwinnable games in government, pause, let's talk about CISA and why gutting your cyber defense agency is a bold strategy. CISA's workforce dropped by a third in under a year, not through some strategic restructuring, not through a thoughtful reorganization, through firings, frozen positions, and an environment so hostile that the people who actually know how to defend American infrastructure are walking out the door. Let me put this in terms that matter. CISA is the agency that coordinates cybersecurity across every federal system, every piece of critical infrastructure, every election network in the country, water treatment plants, power grids, the systems that keep civilization running, and right now the institutional knowledge that protects those systems is evaporating. The comments on this one are worth sitting with. A veteran writes that cybersecurity defense shouldn't be partisan, and they're right, but that framing almost understates the problem. This isn't a policy disagreement, this is a capability being dismantled. One commenter points out you could write this same article about nearly every federal agency right now, and the rebuilding cost, assuming we get there, will be enormous. That qualifier, assuming we get there, is doing a lot of heavy lifting. Now here's where the bootstrapism lens actually matters. Cybersecurity knowledge is one of those domains where open, tooling, shared threat intelligence, and public coordination are the entire game. CISA's real value was never its budget or its office space. It was the network, the relationships with state and local governments, the shared vulnerability databases, the coordinated disclosure processes. Those are open infrastructure patterns. You can't replace them by hiring contractors after the fact, any more than you can rebuild a community by constructing buildings. One dissenting commenter argues CISA was bloated with consultants pushing expensive software licenses, and maybe there's a kernel of truth in that critique, but gutting the agency doesn't fix procurement problems, it just removes the people who understand the threat landscape while leaving the vendor contracts intact. The engineering metaphor here is technical debt at civilizational scale. Every month, without adequate cyber defense coordination, the attack surface grows, the institutional memory fades, and the cost of recovery compounds. The tools to defend these systems exist. The knowledge is available, but knowledge that walks out the door doesn't leave documentation behind. Now for something completely different. Story 7, pause, an ancient Mayan mystery and a missing digit on Stellar C. I've built systems where a single constant, one number buried in a config file, determines whether everything downstream is correct or garbage. Change that constant by 3 and every output shifts. That's exactly the story of Stellar C and the Mayan correlation. In 1939, Marion and Matthew Sterling pulled the bottom half of an Olmec stone monument out of the ground at Tres Zapotes. Carved into it was most of a date in the Mesoamerican long count calendar. 16, 6, 16, 18, but the first digit, the most significant one, was missing. It was on the other half of the stone, which was nowhere to be found. The long count is elegant in its simplicity. It counts days since creation in a modified base 20 system. The first digit represents baktuns, each one 144,000 days. Getting that digit wrong doesn't shift your date by a week, it shifts it by nearly 400 years. The Sterlings argue the missing digit was 7, which would place the inscription at September 3rd, 32 BCE, that made the Olmecs far older than the Mayans. A claim that landed about as well as you'd expect in a field where established experts had already drawn their timelines. 30 years they waited, then in 1969, a farmer turned up the missing half. The digit was 7. The Sterlings had been right all along. But here's what's actually fascinating. The real puzzle isn't the missing digit. It's the conversion constant. To translate a long count date into our calendar, you convert the base 20 number to raw days, add a correlation constant, and map to Julian date. That constant, known as the Mayan correlation, was debated for decades. Getting it wrong by even a few days cascades through every date attribution in Mesoamerican archaeology. The accepted value, 584,283, locks the two calendar systems together with extraordinary precision. The commenters on this one are asking the right question. How do you sync two calendars separated by millennia and an ocean of cultural context? The answer involves cross-referencing astronomical events, colonial-era records, and carbon dating. Multiple independent lines of evidence converging on the same constant. That's not guesswork. That's science doing what science does. Building consensus from independent measurement. The Sterling's vindication took 3 decades and a farmer's plow. The correlation constant took generations of scholars. Knowledge doesn't care about your timeline, it arrives when the evidence is ready. From the patience of evidence to the power of empty space. Story 8. Nothing is the secret to structuring your work. Let me make the strongest case against this idea first. Clearing your workspace to nothing every single time you sit down sounds like a productivity ritual. Dreaming, it's a methodology. You lose context, you lose momentum, you lose the visual cues that were guiding your next move. One commenter nails this. Well-arranged windows are like bowling bumpers, keeping the ball out of the gutter. Why would you remove the bumpers voluntarily? Now, let me tell you why that argument fails on its own terms. Think of it like a surgeon scrubbing in. Every operation begins the same way. Hands underwater, methodical, deliberate, the same sequence every time. It's not because the surgeon forgot how to operate. It's because the ritual of preparation is the preparation. The scrubbing isn't wasted time before the real work. It's the transition from one mental state to another, from the hallway to the operating theater. That's what nothing does for knowledge work. When you clear everything and rebuild your context from scratch, you're not losing information, you're stress testing it. The pieces that matter will come back to you because they're load-bearing. The pieces that don't come back, those were clutter you were carrying out of inertia, not intention. One commenter describes this beautifully. Taking out a small notepad each morning, writing the overriding goal, the next step, the task list, fresh every day. Another describes closing everything at end of day and opening just the first thing needed tomorrow. These people arrived at the same practice independently. That's significant. The GTD crowd recognizes this as foundational. Everything in its place. Everything has a place. But the deeper insight is about trust. You clear to nothing because you trust your systems to hold what matters. You trust your own mind to reconstruct the relevant context. And in that reconstruction, you often notice what you missed yesterday. A dependency you overlooked. An assumption you hadn't questioned. The counter-argument about losing context assumes context is fragile. But if your understanding of a problem can't survive a blank screen and a fresh start, maybe you didn't understand the problem as well as you thought. Moving on. What does it actually take to build a frontier model in 2026? Not the marketing version, the engineering version, the version where you have to solve reinforcement learning at scale before you can even begin training the model that ships. GLM-5 comes from Jipu AI, and the headline numbers are competitive with the best available. Systems engineering, long horizon, agentic tasks, the benchmarks you'd expect. But the comments surfaced something more interesting than the model itself. There's an async reinforcement learning framework called Slime, open sourced under Thudim on GitHub, and it's been quietly powering GLM's last three generations. The model is the product. The training infrastructure is the capability. That distinction matters. When a lab open sources its RL training framework, it's not giving away the model. It's giving away the ladder. Anyone with sufficient compute can now replicate the methodology. The weights are one thing. The process that produces the weights is the deeper contribution. The practical reports from users are measured. GLM 4.7 Flash apparently hits a useful threshold for local coding. Something like Haiku class intelligence at a parameter count, where competitors are still stumbling. One commenter noted, they prefer Minimax for general tasks, but find GLM stronger for code. These are the granular, honest assessments that benchmarks can't capture. Then there's the distillation question. One comment raised what might be the defining tension of the next 2 years. Gray market, fast following via distillation. If every frontier model can be approximated at lower cost within months, the economics of training trillion parameter models from scratch become genuinely uncertain. The labs that survive will be the ones whose training infrastructure moves faster than distillation can follow. Jipu published Slime. That's a bet that openness compounds faster than secrecy protects. The history of this field suggests they're right. There's a practice so simple it almost feels like cheating pause, and it might be the most underrated tool in any builder's kit. 25%, that's the number that caught me. Nick Teets polled his Mastodon followers and found that only a quarter of them keep an engineering notebook. A third didn't even know what one was. And this isn't some obscure technique from a forgotten era. This is one of the oldest productivity practices in engineering, period. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. In 2026, we have every digital tool imaginable. Obsidian, Notion, Logsake, AI-assisted note-taking that transcribes your meetings and summarizes your thoughts. The case against a physical notebook seems overwhelming. It's not searchable, it's not backed up. You can't copy-paste from it. You can't share it in a pull request. By every metric we use to evaluate tools, a paper notebook loses. And yet, that's precisely why it works. Teets describes something that anyone who's tried this recognizes instantly. The act of writing by hand forces a kind of cognitive commitment that typing doesn't. When you write code in a notebook before you write it in your editor, you're compiling it in your head first. You're running the logic through a slower, more deliberate processor. The handwriting isn't a bottleneck. It's a feature. It's forced thinking time in a profession that rewards people for moving fast and breaking things. The detail that reveals the whole picture here is his admission that he almost never reads the notes back. The notebooks aren't a reference system, they're a thinking system. The writing is the work, as he puts it. The artifact is secondary to the process that created it. One commenter nailed something worth highlighting. They pointed out that the physical act of writing drives memory formation, even if the notes themselves never get reviewed. The research supports this. There's something about the motor cortex engaging with abstract thought that digital input just doesn't replicate. What I find genuinely admirable about this practice is its elegant refusal to optimize. In a field obsessed with productivity tools and second brains and knowledge graphs, the engineering notebook is a bound paper object with no API, no plugins, no sync conflicts. It works because it's simple, because it's slow, and because slowness turns out to be a feature when your job is to think clearly about complicated systems. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 12th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated, scripts by Claude Opus 4.6, voice by Quen3 TTS, not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go write something down on paper and see what your hands teach your brain. We'll see you back here tomorrow.